The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower and Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark Amtower. My guest today is a friend of mine, a lawyer. I'm not friendly with too many lawyers. Steve Coprince of Coprince Law. You can find Steve at Coprince, Coprince.com. Steven, welcome back to the show.
Well, good to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Give people a little background in case they don't understand that some lawyers have extraordinarily focused areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of us are friendly, too, and make good friends like yourself. So I'm a federal government contracts lawyer, period. So what I do is I work with, my client base is folks who sell to Uncle Sam, prime contractors or subcontractors. And we work with clients nationwide. Most of the clients are small businesses, but not all. And, of course, small business is a moving target within the various NAICS codes that the government has out there. So we work with clients on federal government issues from compliance to bid protests, claims, team agreements, subcontracts, you name it. But if it's not a federal government contracts issue, we don't do it. And that allows us to be broad within the field of federal contracts without pretending to be everything to everyone.
Okay, cool. And I'm assuming for some of the large, you may advise their business development program managers on partnering rules, et cetera.
That's right. You know, a lot of large companies have come to us to get some advice regarding their relationships with small businesses. So it might be their small business liaisons. Oftentimes it's general counsel at a company that size. But that's often where we start with them. And if they like our services, then sometimes they come back for other things as well. But many of those companies do have their own in-house counsel that do a lot of the work as well.
Okay. I want to touch on this later on because you use social media pretty well. But two of the things you do extraordinarily well in sharing information on what's going on, particularly in the small business contractor arena, your blog, smallgovcon.com. How long have you been doing the blog now?
Blog's coming up 4 years now.
And you post very regularly.
Absolutely, several times a week. When I started the blog 4 years ago, I had this irrational fear that there wouldn't be enough going on in federal government contracts to post regularly about, and that was out the window about the first month of the blog. So several times a week, we've got new posts up there.
Yeah, and it's extraordinarily important for small businesses, especially to have a conduit, a venue where they can get the information regarding small business contracting, and literally that's all the blog covers. Is that accurate?
That's right. What we're covering is legal news and commentary that's relevant to federal contractors, most often small contractors. So it's a lot of coverage of what's going on with regulations, decisions by the GAO, SBA, size protests, socioeconomic programs, all those sorts of things that affect small businesses that can be complex, that there are new developments happening all the time, and we try to distill those in plain English for folks who are out there selling to the government.
Okay. And the other thing you have is the newsletter.
That's right. Every month we publish a newsletter with, 5, 6, 7, 8 articles taken from our blog primarily. So for those who aren't able to read it every day, distill those, the ones that I think are probably the most important for folks to know about. And that's a free electronic newsletter anyone can sign up for, and we'll send it to you every month.
Okay, and you can sign up again at CoprinceLaw.com. So let's take a dive into the current hot issues. Let me ask a different question first. How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing federal government contracts law for 11 years now. And before that, of course, was law school. And before that, I worked for a couple years on Capitol Hill for a member of Congress. And one of the issues I dealt with there was helping contractors. So my background goes back actually to those days on Capitol Hill.
That's funny. Larry Allen did the same thing on the Hill before he went to the coalition, and then he went out on his own. But the reason I asked is, especially with your Hill background, have you ever seen a Congress that hasn't dealt with, and just in your career, hasn't dealt with small business in some way? It seems like there's a plethora of competing or cross-referencing bills in every Congress.
Yeah, absolutely. That's my that's always been my impression every year. In fact, you know, we myself and those who practice in my field in federal government contracts law, we're always looking for these competing bills. These bills are out there on small businesses every year. And then we also look every year, of course, at anything that passes, but most specifically the National Defense Authorization Act, because that has become a vehicle in which a lot of these bills that are proposed separately are then wrapped into the NDAA every year. So the NDAA becomes a vehicle for changing the rules for small contractors almost every year, it seems.
Yeah. And Lord, you know, tons of lip service, but, you know, from a practical standpoint, I don't usually see enough traction.
Yeah, I mean, what Congress is usually good at is picking around the edges. I mean, the status quo is it's just tough to defeat at anything, I think. And so when Congress changes the rules, and they do, they're out there constantly changing them, but big comprehensive change, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, is usually elusive. It's the, you know, picking around the edges, changing the rules, tweaking them here and there, that is what Congress often does. And yet those little tweaks can have major ramifications for contractors. So that's something that we keep a close eye on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if you and me and Timberlake sat down over a root beer, we would probably be able to come up with a fairly comprehensive set of guidelines that would help small business instead of hindering them with more regulations than large businesses have to face. So,
yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. We probably could, and yet that's not how it works, because a lot of the time what happens is there are more regulations imposed when Congress gets together. That's what they do. They write rules.
Yeah, and, you know, if the small businesses could get together and say, hey, you know, make sense or you're being replaced, maybe something would happen. But let's go to probably the hottest small business issue of the day. SBA and the woman-owned small business self-certification site. Talk about your conflicting rules. Is self-certification for women businesses in or out, or what's going on here?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and the answer is it depends who you ask. If you ask Congress, the answer is self-certification is out. It was eliminated by the National Defense Authorization Act a couple years ago. And if you ask SBA, it's still in, because SBA still says that it hasn't had time to adjust to Congress's change. And so it is really a program in flux. And the question of whether a woman-owned small business can self-certify for a WSB set-aside or sole source contract, to me, is completely up in the air, because what Congress did is at odds with what SBA is telling everybody.
Well, what's a contracting officer supposed to do in the meantime?
Well, that's a good question, and there have been reports that I've seen, I don't have hard numbers, that contracting officers still aren't using WSB set-asides and sole sources that often, and this may be one of the reasons, because they're getting different information from different sources. If I'm a contracting officer, I would ask that the women-owned small businesses that were submitting offers be certified by one of the third-party certifiers that does that. That way I know I'm safe. You know, I know that if, once I make the award, I'm not worried that somebody's going to protest and say that those companies shouldn't have been the award of the contract because they weren't certified.
Okay. But you know, SBA has a – is it a new website, or is it a revised website, or what?
Yeah, what SBA has done recently is that they created a site called certify.sba.gov. It is a new website. It takes the place of what was previously called the WSB Woman-Owned Small Business Document Repository. And a WSB Document Repository is a place where self-certified women-owned small businesses would submit their documents to have those documents considered by the contracting officer and potentially by the SBA in the event that the self-certified woman-owned small business was awarded a set-aside contract. And so, you know, that, in my view, hey, if we're going to eliminate self-certification, the repository itself is unnecessary. But instead of eliminating the repository, SBA apparently has invested the time and resources to modernize it and put it into a new website, certify.sba.gov.
How weird. You know, I'm not surprised, but whatever. We're going to take our first break. You're listening to AM Tower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Steve and I will be back after these messages. Welcome back to AM Tower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest is Steve Koprince. You can find Steve at Koprince, K-O-P-R-I-N-C-E.com. You can find him on LinkedIn. When you go to his website, though, sign up for the RSS feed for the blog and sign up for the newsletter. And I didn't mention it before, but Steve has a great – it may be a little dated at this point, but if you read the blog, it'll keep you up to date. The Small Business Guide to Government Contracting came out, what, 3-4 years ago, Steve?
That's right, 2012. And anyone who's got a copy of that book, you know, take a look at the back jacket. Mr. Mark Amtower's name is on the back of the book as well.
Yeah, I got a jacket blurb in there.
It wasn't
my post office photo. This time, wrap up on the WSOB before we continue.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the takeaway here, WSB program, it's in a state of flux. It's unclear whether self-certification is still legally valid, or whether certification is required. So what I'm telling my clients is, look, the safe bet here is to just go ahead, get certified with one of those third-party certifiers. They're unpopular in some quarters, but be that as it may, that's a safe bet. I don't want any of my clients to be the legal guinea pig, get protested, and then they have their name on the case that decides whether or not self-certification is legally still valid here in 2016.
Okay, cool. Big item number two, a while back, or maybe they're still in the process, I haven't been monitoring that close, they recompeted STARS 2, or they did an on-ramp, because apparently a number of 8A companies graduated from the program, but recently you talked about participation in the program being down. What's happening here?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there was a report that came out from the SBA Office of Inspector General not that long ago, and focused really on a different topic. But what the report included were some numbers on 8A program participation over the years, and they're pretty shocking. I mean, what the report shows is that, you know, the overall 8A program participation is down 34% over the last 6 years, since just 2010, from about 7,000 firms that were 8A certified in 2010, only about 4,500 8A firms certified as we speak here in 2016.
Okay. Now, when you started your practice, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't 7,000 really low? I mean, wasn't there closer to 9 or 10?
That's right. I mean, when I started this firm, or my private practice, just a blog of about 4 years ago, that seemed like a low number then, 7,000, because you go back a few years earlier and we were around 10,000. So if you keep turning the clock back, maybe, you know, now 10 years, you're looking at a 50% plus drop in 8A firms.
Why?
That's a good question. And I put this post out on my blog about 8A participation being down. And I've gotten all sorts of feedback from the public about answers, from everything from, you know, the baby boomers retiring to sequestration and, you know, so on and so on. And I think that by and large, there are a number of factors here. But what's clear from the SBA's report is that the SBA believes that at least some of it has to do with the difficulties that applicants are facing in just getting into the program. Qualified applicants, folks who would qualify for the 8A program, having a lot of trouble just navigating the process and getting admitted. And so SBA is planning to improve, streamline the application process to at least address the piece of this that can be addressed internally by SBA.
Okay. But I mean, overall, is the application process onerous? Does it require excessive information from the companies applying? Is there any problem in that area?
I would say yes, and, you know, excessive is in the eye of the beholder, but the fact is that the 8A application requires a lot of information, a ton of information, of documents. It's a lengthy process. It can take months. I've known companies that it's taken them years to go through this application process. It's often been, and this is, of course, on a case-by-case basis, and I don't want to tar at anybody at SBA with a broad brush, but it has often, from my clients at least, who are the ones who are calling their lawyer because they're having trouble, been difficult for them to get in touch with the SBA analysts to discuss the application. The analysts are sending them back deficiency letters, essentially, that indicate that there's problems with the application, but it looks on further review like the analyst just didn't see it or didn't read something in there. So there have been a number of problems that have led, I think, some qualified companies to just throw up their hands and say, you know what, forget it. If I've got to pay a lawyer, if I've got to pay a consultant, I got to deal with this back and forth over the course of a couple years with SBA, just not worth it to get this 8A certification.
Once you get it, though, does it remain a huge positive for the 8A participants?
It can be, and it depends on the 8A participant and what their business plan is and how they intend to use it, because there are, I think, two types of 8A participants. There are those who get 8A going in knowing, here's our plan to use it. Here's our customers we're going to target. Here's the mentor we're going to get. Here are the joint ventures we're going to form. Here's how we're going to leverage fully that 9-year participation term. And those folks tend to do very well in the program because there are a lot of 8A dollars awarded. And the second camp is people who, for whatever reason, and you see this sometimes with GSA schedules too, think that if they get an 8A certification, the contracts are just going to start raining down from heaven on them. And that's not how it works. You know, the 8A certification is, it's a hunting license. It's a, allows you access to an exclusive club and a bunch of benefits that can be part of the process, but you got to work for them and you got to know how to go out and get them. And so if you're in that latter camp where you're just getting 8A certification because you think that once you do, the contracts will just flow from nowhere, those folks don't tend to do as well in the 8A program.
Well, we've heard the same thing about, you know, getting a GSA schedule. Number one, it is not an easy process necessarily. Adult supervision is recommended from my point of view, i.e. get legitimate help, not some slime bag from Tampa. No names, but in that general area. But there's another problem that's similar too, and that is the customer service side. I keep hearing from companies out there that, you know, during the process of applying for a schedule or doing mods, it's hard to get in touch with their contracting rep. Some similar issues there. So get a GWAC, you'll be happier. And there's lots of room for small businesses and 8As and hubs and women-owned and veterans on GWACs if you're in time to get there. So,
yep, that's absolutely right. And interestingly, you mentioned GSA schedule, and I think, you know, that is a great analogy. And interestingly, you know, you've seen this too, I'm sure, GSA saying, we want to start streamlining the schedule process because it's becoming too difficult. We're going to test this, you know, streamlined process for Schedule 70, for example, because they're seeing the same problem that 8A, that folks are just throwing up their hands and saying, yeah, this is too complicated. There are other ways I can get a piece of the government market without having to go through this process.
Yeah. So next topic, we'll start and carry it over to the next segment, but you recently wrote about limitations on subcontracting, SBA proposing some changes here.
That's right. And these changes, we talked earlier about the National Defense Authorization Act and how every year that bill seems to change some of the rules for small contractors. In 2013, the 2013 NDAA, Congress went in and amended the Small Business Act, which is the governing statute for the SBA and its size programs, and changed the limitations on subcontracting for manufacturing and, most importantly, I think, services contracts that are set aside for small businesses and any socioeconomic category of small business. So what's happening now is that's a statutory change. SBA has proposed regulations to implement that statutory change, and those regulations are probably going to go final in the next several months here, which will change the longstanding formulas for calculating whether companies are actually in compliance with the limitations on subcontracting.
Okay. Now, is this going to impact or improve a prime's ability to claim the sub for the agency's set-aside goals?
Yeah, it will. I think this includes a really important piece called what SBA calls a similarly situated entity. So what that means is the way the limitations on subcontracting currently work under the FAR and the SBA's regulations for general small business set-asides is that the prime has to perform a certain percentage of the work with its own forces, period, no matter who the subcontractors are.
Right, yeah.
And what the change does is it the change says, well, what we really are interested in from a policy perspective is not that the specific company do 50% of the work, but that a certain percentage of the benefits flow to small businesses at whatever tier. And so the small prime is now going to be able, under this changed rule, to count work performed by small business subcontractors in support of the prime's own 50% or whatever the number is, compliance at the prime level.
Okay, cool. Just in time for our next break. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower, and Steve and I will be back right after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest today is Steve Koprince. You can find Steve at koprince.com. He is not in D.C., but he's here frequently. He speaks around the country on small business issues. Got the blog, got the newsletter, got the website. You can find him on LinkedIn as well. So on the let's follow up a little bit on the small biz thing. SBA put out its Small Business Federal Procurement Scorecard, and they're claiming victory yet again. But it seems to me that this is the third year in a row, and that the first year, I believe their inspector general came out and said, hold on, I don't believe this is accurate. So kudos for bumping the numbers, but are they inflated?
Yeah, that's a good question, and historically they have been inflated, actually, you know, because historically what the SBA has done with its numbers is it has excluded all contracts that were performed overseas as if they didn't exist, as if those dollars didn't count. And so the numbers, the denominator was essentially being goosed in prior years. There was actually legislation introduced earlier this year or last year, I forget which, to require the SBA to include all contracts, including those performed outside the continental U.S. SBA has claimed they're going to do it and then said, but when we do, the numbers are going to drop. And the numbers didn't drop, and I don't know whether they did it or not. But they, to back to your point, at least with respect to previous years, yeah, they've been the numbers have been goosed essentially by the fact that an entire category of contracts have been excluded.
Well, that's not very nice.
Yeah, well, it's not very nice. I think it gives a false sense of achievement. If you say, hey, we've gotten 23, we've gotten 25, but it's based on a subset of data that's been limited geographically for no apparent reason that either I can think of or even the SBA, when they were put to the question, could think of, it doesn't make much sense to me other than to give everybody a false sense of achievement.
Okay, well, I'm hoping that the 20 agencies that got an A on the scorecard at least legitimately bumped their small biz participation. It would be nice to see, again, more teeth from Congress in legislation regarding that and a clear path to both getting there and understanding that it's real.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, I'll give plenty of agencies credit. There are agencies that take their goals and their small business goals very seriously. But these A scores and these A plus scores, they do bother me. It looks like great inflation at a college or university, because the numbers, these agencies, most of them that have achieved these A or even A plus, have not achieved all the goals that SBA has set forth for them. For example, there's a hub zone goal, 3%. And nobody or almost nobody hit that. In fact, their folks, their agencies, GSA, I believe, got an A+, and they were at maybe 0.7% hub zone. So that was one of their goals. And so to me, if you can't hit every goal that SBA has set out for you, that shouldn't be an A+. I'm glad that they did real well with their underlying small business goal, but missing one of the targets, to me, that's not an A+.
No, me either. And, you know, I teach grad school occasionally, and I tell people when they come in first day, you know, if you're here for an A, you're probably in the wrong class.
that's how it should be. I mean, and it seems to me that These scores have been curved upward. Again, I give agencies credit where it's due for increasing small business participation. A lot to take it seriously. But if you can get an A-plus without hitting all your goals, what incentive is left to hit those remaining goals?
Exactly. So next topic, yet again, SBA OHA sets low bar for common investments affiliation. Another topic from your blog. What does this mean?
Yeah, and this one, it starts to sound wonky, but it's really important. So the SBA has, as many small businesses know, affiliation rules. In cases in which the SBA will say, well, this business isn't really small because it's affiliated with another business. Some of those rules are very intuitive. If I own 100% of two companies, they're affiliated because I own 100% of both, I control them both. People, I think, intuitively understand those sorts of affiliation rules. But there are others that aren't intuitive. And one of those is what's called the common investments affiliation rule. And what that means is that when the owners of one company, this is when there are multiple owners in a company, let's say just hypothetically 250% owners in a company, and those same individuals have common interests in other companies, that the SBA may treat those people as if they're one person for purposes of applying the affiliation rule. So just very basic. Let's say that you and I, Mark, we own 50% each of, we'll call it Company A. And then at Company B, you own 75%, I own 25%. Company C, let's flip that. I own 75%, you own 25%. What SBA may do is say, well, you know, Steve and Mark, you guys have a common interest in three companies. Just because of that, because you've tied your economic destinies together, we're going to say that the Steve Mark team has 100% interest in all three companies, and that means those three companies are affiliated with each other, even though I would come back and say, well, wait a second, I only own 25% of one. I don't control it. And you'd say the same about the other. And so the SBA might lump them all together. And this can really hurt small businesses because it's not an intuitive affiliation rule. And there are a lot of business owners who have multiple interests out there in different companies. And when they hold a minority interest, they often presume that company won't be affiliated. I'm just an investor. And this rule says otherwise. And what the SBA Office of Hearings and Appeals recently held, contrary to common popular perception before, which said that in order to have that economic affiliation, the economic common investments affiliation applied, the two people in question, it's usually two, had to have interest in at least three or more companies. Recently, just a couple of weeks ago, SBA Office of Hearings and Appeals applied it to a situation in which the two people in question had common interest in only two companies, just two. They said, of course, common interest in one isn't enough. But at this point, if you and I have interest in just two companies together, those companies could be deemed affiliated. And so it's a tough one. It's a little wonky. It's hard to break it down perfectly for your listeners, Mark, but it is one of those things that can get even savvy small business owners in size trouble with the SBA.
Well, I mean, the flag for anybody out there listening is if you have investors or partners who own parts of other companies, you know, check with your lawyer.
That's right. And I will tell you, you know, I've had an increase in people who own interest in multiple companies in particular coming to me for internal affiliation audits. In other words, you pretend you're the SBA. You tell us whether you think that we've got a problem. And if so, how do we fix it? And before we get a size protest levied against us. And so we've been doing an increasing amount of that work.
And that doesn't surprise me. I mean, you know, this goes back to the one line or one paragraph I read in your book. And number one, for all you listeners out there, get a copy of the Small Business Guide to Government Contracting because it is extraordinarily readable and it's actually a fun read. But Steve, in there, you said that small businesses have more regulatory issues than large businesses when it comes to contracting.
Yeah, and I still believe that now. You know, the book came out in 2012, and I still believe that now because as a small business, you've got to worry about all these size and affiliation rules that the larges typically don't have to deal with. And so as a small business, you got to figure out, are you affiliated? Are you a small business? Often, are you complying with the regulations under a certain socioeconomic program, which can be very tricky as well. And so you've got the very businesses that don't have typically the resources to have a full-time in-house attorney to help them, and they're placed under this regime in which the FAR generally applies to everybody, large and small alike, and then the small businesses have this extra set of regulations from the SBA most frequently put on top of that. So it's a tough thing for a small business.
It's an insane thing, and that's all the more reason that if small businesses are going to come into the government market, they've got to do so intelligently, and they have to have the right legal advice on the way in.
Right, and look, I mean, I'm biased. I tell people this, you know, hey, I'm a government contract attorney, I'm biased, but it makes so much more sense to spend a little time talking with a legal advisor up front before making a business decision, rather than just assuming that you're making the right decision and asking someone to unwind it after the fact, which is often very tough to do. Because I get the calls from people who have gone down the wrong path with regards to an affiliation or a certification problem or something else in the government contracting world. And often there's only so much I can do after the fact. It's a conversation that I wish we had had 6 months earlier.
Right. And in Selling to the Government, which came out a year before your book, I said that 90% of the companies coming into the government market were going to leave within a year and blame everybody but themselves. And that's not based on, you know, scientific fact. That's based on experiential observation. But I think it's a pretty accurate figure.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, that's exactly right, is that, people sometimes it goes back to what we were talking about with the 8A. There's this mindset that if I sign up for SAM or get my 8A or get my GSA schedule, well, then, you know, the government's just going to start handing me cash. And
phone's going to ring.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yep. That fax machine's going to crank right up.
good old fax machine, yes, if you're still doing business in that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're doing business that way, that's about the time frame when those things may have had an impact, but I don't think they ever
did. That's right.
We're going to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We will be back after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest is Steve Koprince. Find Steve at KOPRINCE.com. Look him up on LinkedIn. Subscribe to the newsletter. You know, if you're a small business and you're not reading this stuff, you're going to be behind the curve, and being behind the curve in this market means sooner or later you're going to get whacked with a brick. So just do it. Relatively simple. Right? Okay, so next topic. There's a proposed amendment seeking to, and we've never heard this before, level the playing field for small business contractors by reducing barriers in the participation of small businesses as primes. What is this? Is it new? Give us the real skinny here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a bill called the Small Contractors Improved Competition Act of 2015. These all have these fun names on them. I think what this is it is new, but it's not new. I think what this kind of does is it aggregates some ideas that have been floating around, proposed earlier, into a single bill, and kind of presents them as maybe a aggregated solution to the problem of what some see as not a level playing field. Does it level the playing field? Of course not. I mean, you know, nothing's ever going to level the playing field for small businesses, but it's not an unreasonable piece of legislation either, for the most part. It does. But again, it's probably more what we started talking about, picking at some of the margins of this stuff rather than a comprehensive solution. But it does, attempt to pull back a little bit on bundling and consolidation of contract opportunities, encouraging agencies to follow up more with prime contractors on their subcontracting goals. There's some limitations on reverse auctions, which I don't know if that's really a plus or a minus for small business, reverse auctions, of course, are a very polarizing topic. But interestingly to me, this bill starts off by saying, you know, government officials prefer doing business with contractors they know, and that can be a problem for small business. And then says, and one of the ways we're going to solve this problem is by doing away with certain reverse auctions.
Yay.
And yet a reverse auction is often where someone who with no experience can get their foot in the door. So it doesn't make, you know, that piece doesn't really fit with the intent of the bill. But yeah, so it's an aggregation. It allows small distributors to be what's called non-manufacturers under certain socioeconomic set-asides, where I'd argue they probably already are, but it clarifies that. So it's not I'm not opposed to the goals of this bill necessarily, but you know, anyone who calls this a sweeping change that will level the playing field, well, it's certainly not that.
Well, it's not like we haven't heard level the playing field before, and this playing field's never going to be level. Intelligent companies are going to level it in their favor, and that's the bottom line.
Well, that's exactly right. It's intelligent companies at any step in the process are going to level it in their favor, and you know, contracting officers retain such large discretion, as I think largely is a good thing in this arena, and maybe sometimes it's too far. But these bills don't, you know, do a whole lot to cut back on the discretion of contracting officers to ultimately select the contractor that they want. And if that's a small business, that's great, but sometimes it's not.
Okay. All right, so before the show, I asked you to come up with a couple of tips for our listeners, and I'm just going to let you run right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm doing, you know, Mark, we talked about my book that came out in 2012, and I am actually in the early stages of putting together what will hopefully be a second edition of that book coming out maybe 2017, 2018. And one of the things that I'm trying to do there is include a new feature that I'm calling Myth versus Realities, which is basically what are the common misconceptions that I'm seeing from small businesses, people who call me with the same misconceptions, the same concerns, and yet they're just not correct based on what they're saying, and it's specifically relating to small businesses and government contracting. So one thing that I've seen a lot is confusion about NAICS codes, these North American Industry Classification System codes. And I have a lot of contractors that come to me and they say, for example, I am a small business because I've only earned, you know, $2 million in the NAICS code that's under this solicitation, or I've only earned, you know, $2 million in services NAICS codes over the last 3 years. And so, you know, one of the things that is the reality rather than the myth is that when the SBA calculates a company's size, it is based on the company's average annual receipts over the last 3 years if it's a revenue-based NAICS code. And there's no exclusion for the NAICS code. There's no exclusion for non-federal work. There's no exclusion for work as a subcontractor. There's no exclusion for commercial work. And folks are often trying to limit the number that the SBA is using. It's a tax return thing. It's the, you know, it's the total income plus cost of goods sold on the tax return, wherever that came from. And so there's a lot of confusion about that point as well. And I think in a similar vein, Mark, we have a lot of confusion about how the SAM profile interacts with the small business rules. And so companies that are involved in federal government contracting, of course, they're all familiar with SAM for better or for worse, often for worse. And they're also familiar with the fact that SAM profiles must be updated once a year, at least once a year. And what I have had a lot of companies come to me and say is, look, I've updated my SAM profile. I was a small business or a woman-owned business or a service-disabled business or a small disadvantaged business when I updated my SAM profile. It's been less than a year, but that has changed somehow. My company's grown or the woman owner retired or whatever the case is. But I still qualify as that until I have to, whatever that was, small, let's say, until I have to redo my SAM profile in 1 year. In other words, I can maintain that status until the SAM profile needs to be updated. And that's not correct. That's not true. What the FAR says is that a SAM profile needs to be current, accurate, and complete at the time that the contractor is using that SAM profile to self-certify on any sort of solicitation. So if the SAM profile is outdated, it's incorrect, and it's been less than a year, then the contractor cannot validly submit an offer on a solicitation in reliance on that outdated profile, because the profile is not current, it's not accurate, it may or may not be complete as well. So that gets folks confused as well, confused about the SAM profile and when that SAM profile can it really is not tied to size at all. It's a representation of current size and should be updated anytime the contractor size changes. One more in a similar vein, and I've actually had contracting officers extremely confused about this. And this, but the question of NAICS codes and SAM profiles, NAICS codes and SAM profiles. And I've had contracting officers, this has happened multiple times now, say to my client, you cannot be awarded this contract because you don't have, you know, whatever the solicitation's NAICS code listed on your SAM profile. And that is completely wrong, A contractor is not required to list or not list any specific NAICS codes on SAM profile. It's up to the contractor to list whatever it wants. I mean, in terms of the NAICS codes listed on the SAM profile, that's essentially the contractor's capability statement. It's telling the world what that contractor does and what type of work it does. And you don't have to, as a contractor, have any specific NAICS code listed on your profile to, for example, bid upon and be awarded a contract under a solicitation carrying that specific NAICS code. And you can, of course, add and subtract them anytime you want just by going into your SAM profile and doing it. So I've had contracting officers on multiple occasions telling my clients, you don't have this NAICS code, you can't get awarded the contract. The SBA hasn't certified you under this NAICS code as a small business. SBA does not do that unless there's been a size protest or formal size challenge, self-certification. And so this is a confusion among some of the small businesses out there, but even more so among some of the contracting officers that are out there. So those are a few of the SAM profile and NAICS codes issues, and I'll stop rambling for now, Mark, and see where we are on time. But I've got a few on socioeconomic programs if you want me to take a crack at those.
Well, it's about time to wrap anyway, Steve. So put them in your blog, save them for the next show. find venues to share them, because it's all good stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it, Mark, and it's been a real pleasure being here today with you.
Always a pleasure to have you, Steve. This is not my day job, so if you need help with your marketing program, small biz or large biz, or if you want to learn how to use LinkedIn for business development and reaching out to the 1.6 million feds that are on LinkedIn, give me a shout. You can find me at federaldirect.net or email me at mark@federaldirect.net. And save the date, July 21. I've partnered with the Federal Business Council to produce Federal Channel's Government Marketing Best Practices 2020. among our sponsors is my other company, Government Market Master, Continuing Professional Education. The Government Marketing University is a sponsor. GovEvents is a sponsor. And, of course, Federal Business Council. So save the date. Information at my blog at federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.